You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez.
On April 4, 1949, the North Atlantic Treaty was signed between France, Belgium, Luxembourg, the Netherlands.
Since its founding, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, better known as NATO, has grown in membership from the 12 founders to 30 members today. And through the end of the Cold War, the alliance was principally focused on a sort of strategic reassurance in Europe.
An attack against one would be an attack against all.
As the organization's first Secretary General, Lord Ismay, famously put it, NATO exists to, quote, keep the Americans in, the Russians out, and the Germans down. But after the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991, NATO faced an identity crisis. Without the persistent threat of Soviet expansion, what was the point of NATO?
I was asked on a major show, what do you think of NATO? And I have to understand, I'm a business person. I did really well.
And in 2016, after 25 years of a mostly quiet peacekeeping presence in Europe, that question became a headline.
NATO is obsolete. It was 67 years, or it's over 60 years old.
It was shocking to hear this. When for 60 plus years, you had had a relationship with the United States based really on a set of common values and common interests.
Ivo Dalder was U.S. ambassador to NATO under President Barack Obama. He's now head of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs.
To all of a sudden hear that the organization that had been at the core of your security for so long was, quote, obsolete, that your major ally was talking about you in deeply disdainful terms.
Brussels. I was in Brussels a long time ago, 20 years ago. So beautiful, everything's so beautiful. It's like living in a hellhole right now. You go to these
even as the president was embracing your enemies as the folks who could be trusted, including more trusted than his own intelligence services, as we found out with regard to Vladimir Putin.
I was in Russia. I was in Moscow recently, and I spoke indirectly and directly with President Putin, who could not have been nicer.
And so, as Biden rightly said when he came back, making him president, said, America's back.
I speak today as President of the United States at the very start of my administration, and I'm sending a clear message to the world. America is back.
And he went to Europe, remember, in June of 2021 for a NATO meeting, for a G7 meeting, and kept on saying, we're back, we're here, and making the kind of, you know, frankly, statements that every president, with the exception of Donald Trump, had made since Harry Truman.
But the United States is determined to reengage with Europe, to consult with you, to earn back our position of trusted leadership.
He would remind people, he said, you know, when I say that I'm back, most of the people say, yes, but for how long? And so the impact that Trump has left on the relationship with its allies is deep. And there is a concern that, frankly, the kinds of things we see today and have regarded as normal may not always last.
Whether America is back for good remains to be seen. But Russia's invasion of Ukraine, a country that isn't even a member of NATO, has forced the alliance back into the headlines and re-energized a transatlantic partnership that was starting to feel a little frayed. Ambassador Ivo Dalder, it's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, great to be here.
Vladimir Putin puts NATO at the heart of his explanation for his war on Ukraine. So first things first. In December 2021, in January 2022, in the weeks leading up to the invasion, did Russia have anything to fear from NATO?
No. And the fact that Vladimir Putin has decided to blame NATO for what is really a war of aggression against a neighbor that was not a member of NATO, wasn't going to be a member of NATO anytime soon, and didn't pose in any way a threat to Russia, just demonstrates how far removed we have gone from, you know, the kind of normal way states behave towards each other. NATO has been a bugaboo for the Russians for a very long time, and for Vladimir Putin in particular. There's a good history behind it that we can get into. But the reality is he wanted to control Ukraine. There were historical reasons for this. There were ideological reasons for this. But Vladimir Putin wanted to control the Ukraine. He needed to find a way to do that. He tried in 2014 with sort of hybrid warfare when he took over Crimea and started to support a separatist movement in the Donbas region. That continued for 8 years, but he wasn't getting what he needed. He wanted control of Ukraine, and he decided on February 24th to invade Ukraine. It had nothing to do with NATO. It had everything to do with Russia and Vladimir Putin's desire to control its neighbor. It's important to remember that this is what is at stake. We have rules. Our international system is based on countries abiding by those rules. And in this case, they were violated, not because NATO expanded back in the 1990s and the 2000s. All steps, by the way, taken not only with the understanding of Russia, but in some cases openly supported. Even the movement of the three Baltic states, which had never been recognized as part of the Soviet Union, into NATO in 2004, Putin reacted to that step of saying, you know, if that's what countries want to do, that's what countries want to do. In fact, Finland and Sweden, two countries that now want to join NATO, in part because he invaded Ukraine, Putin's reaction in the end was it really wasn't any problem that they would join NATO. So the idea somehow that this is all because of NATO, not because of what Russia wants with Ukraine, has been discredited. And those who still want to believe in that probably need to do some new research on their own history.
We're just over 3 months in. Western Europe is now officially scrambling to wean itself off Russian fossil fuels. Russia's army is being ground down by surprisingly competent and increasingly well-equipped Ukrainian resistance. And Russia's border with NATO may eventually quadruple in size. Does such a thorough repudiation of Russia's war aims also bring with it the risk of a much longer war in Europe?
Yeah, I think the fact that Russia was unable to achieve any of its immediate objectives, it did not control Kiev, it's not controlling the country of Ukraine. It is fighting now in the south and the east of the country and is making a little bit of progress. But even that, the kind of costs that have been inflicted on Russia, militarily by the Ukrainians, the number of people who apparently have died on the Russian side are already greater than all of the Soviet soldiers that died during the Afghan war between the Soviet Union after its invasion in 1979. More people have died in 3 months than in the 10 years of that war. The economic cost that has come about by the extraordinary sanctions that the United States and its allies in Europe and around the world, really democratic allies around the world, have imposed on Russia are taking its toll. And so, given the calamity of this decision by Vladimir Putin, there is this worry that he won't be able to accept the reality that he has miscalculated, that he has lost, and he's going to continue, given that he controls the country with an iron fist, continue to try to get the most out of it. And that suggests that this war, unfortunately, is going to be longer than it ought to be. It's not going to be over in any time soon, certainly not in the next weeks or even months, in part because, of course, the Ukrainians are not going to settle for anything less than trying to recapture all of the territory that has been occupied by the Russians, at least since February 24th, if not actually since 2014 itself.
Does that longer war than any of the major stakeholders contemplated carry with it, embedded in it, the promise of, the threat of, a realigned world when the smoke clears? I mean, there are some interesting connections and interesting fallings out going on right as we speak that wouldn't have been predictable 6 months ago.
Yeah, I think we're seeing a realignment in a number of ways. I mean, first, of course, is the increasingly stronger ties between Moscow and Beijing, between Xi Jinping himself and Vladimir Putin. Although China has not directly supported Russia, it is not sending military equipment as far as we know, It is not directly doing much to undermine the real sanctions that are being imposed on Russia. Rhetorically, the Chinese have been 100% with the Russians, even buying the argument that somehow this war is justified because NATO was infringing on the security of Russia. And so you do see this stronger alignment between Russia and China on the one hand. Clearly, on the other side, the United States and its democratic allies, not just in Europe and North America, but also in Asia, clearly have seen the need to become more united, more able to deal with the threat from Russia and increasingly from China by cooperating together. A much stronger NATO response already, more being spent on defense. The kind of sanctions that we talked about that not only the EU and the United States, but also countries like Switzerland, a neutral country that has never been involved in sanctioning, now imposing financial sanctions on Russia, and indeed Japan and South Korea, Singapore, and countries are all uniting against Russia and to some extent against China. And then there's a third group of people who are sitting in between. They're the, let's call them the fence sitters, who are trying to determine where the balance of power between the axis of autocracy, if you want, Moscow and Beijing, and the democratic world, where they're going to be. Countries like India, that on the one hand have serious security problems with China, but on the other hand are highly reliant on Russia for weapons, are sitting on the side. Much of Africa and Latin America is waiting out and seeing whether this is going to fundamentally change the nature between their relationship with China, a big investor in their region, and the United States and others. So that's, the world is a very different world today than it was, as you said, 6 months ago.
Well, President Zelensky, along with urging countries that have great wealth and great resources, has made a broader argument to the rest of the world, let's say. He's repeatedly insisted that there's not only plenty at stake in this war for his own country, but that this is a war for the freedom and security of the rest of the world as well. Is he right? And if he is, what can you conclude about South Africa's Cyril Ramaphosa, many other leaders, really, as you just described, sitting this one out, waiting to see what happens at the end? Do other countries, and I should say, to their credit, the ambassador of Kenya to the United Nations spoke up quite forthrightly about the inviolability of international borders and how if this can happen to Ukraine, it can happen all over Africa. So there was that exception. But there are a lot of countries just keeping quiet and sitting this one out. Yes, Zelensky's cut quite a dashing figure in the world, but if you're making a harder calculation, how would you talk to Cyril Ramaphosa and say, look, no, you do have some skin in this game?
Yeah, no, I think that what Zelensky says is the case. It is that he is defending not just freedom, although he's doing that, but actually that Ukraine is standing up for a very fundamental principle, that big countries don't invade small countries and change the borders. Because once that happens and it succeeds in a place like Ukraine, it can happen in a place like East Asia with regard to China and Taiwan, or indeed anywhere in Africa or in Latin America. And the case to make, and the case that Zelensky makes probably better than anyone else, is in fact to say that if we don't abide by rules, if we allow bullies to succeed in bullying their neighbors, then what kind of world is this? What kind of safety is there for a country like South Africa, or even worse, a smaller country that actually can be attacked by a neighboring country? And you mentioned the Kenyan ambassador to the United Nations, who really, in an incredibly eloquent speech immediately after the invasion, said, you know, we're in Africa, a continent of 55 countries, and our borders were all drawn by colonialists. We had nothing to do with it. It cut across tribes, nations, and all kinds of ways that made no sense. And yet we all agreed that we were going to accept those borders, because if we didn't accept those borders, if one country decided to invade another country, then where was it going to end? Everybody was going to invade everybody. And so we were much better off as a continent to accept even borders we didn't like, because the alternative would be chaos. And that is really what is at stake. Decolonization has happened throughout history. The Soviet Empire broke up. In fact, the Russian state is still an empire itself today. And the idea that somehow there is some justification for a big country to invade another country just because they don't like where the border was drawn is a recipe for chaos. So that's the argument to make to the South Africans, to others, that what's good for Africa, frankly, should be good for the world, which is countries that are small in particular need to resist and stand up against those who are bullying and stand with those who are bullied.
Recently on this program, an advisor to President Niinisto of Finland made Finnish membership sound like the most natural, logical thing in the world once Russia invaded Ukraine. As someone who knows the organization well, as someone who's been watching these questions about accession for a long time, were you surprised by the speed with which Finnish and Swedish public opinion shifted on membership?
Yeah, it was surprising. Although once, in fact, European public opinion shifted, which it really did very quickly after the 24th of February when the invasion started, it was quite natural to think that things would move very quickly in Finland and Sweden in the same way. And here's the lesson, because it gets back to the early part of our conversation. Before the war, the United States, President Biden, NATO, Secretary General NATO, made very clear that they would not come and defend Ukraine if it were attacked. They would provide military capabilities, Stinger missiles, etc., but no troops. There would be no defense because, as they said, Ukraine is not a member of NATO. Therefore, the idea that somehow the problem was that Ukraine may someday become a member rather than the fact that they were not a member would provoke Russia. And so that's the lesson that the Finns learned. They said, wait a minute. We're no longer secure in a world in which when you're not a member of NATO, you can be attacked by your neighbor if it's bigger and stronger, in this case, Russia. And therefore, they should become a member of NATO. That's the lesson. The lesson they learned is that if you are a member of NATO, you are going to be protected. You're unlikely to be attacked. If you're not a member of NATO, then you're more likely to be attacked. And that's, of course, exactly contrary to the lesson that critics of NATO have been holding up in justifying Russian behavior over the last few years, including some even justifying this invasion today, blaming NATO and the West for Russia taking the actions that it has.
President Erdogan has raised significant objections to both Finnish and Swedish membership in NATO, and approval of accession, if I understand this correctly, has to be unanimous. There have been consultations between the Turks, Finns, and Swedes, and the Turkish leader says he's still not satisfied, even after those consultations. Does this spell trouble in the weeks and months ahead?
Well, first, it's true that in order for a country to be invited to join NATO, that invitation has to be unanimous because it involves a change in the treaty. And as a result, all the countries will have to ratify those changes. So Turkey has a veto. Any country has a veto. The Turks are the only ones who have expressed it. It's the reality of an organization that operates on the basis of consensus that some countries are able to use that reality for their own political and other purposes. Turkey has serious concerns with regard to its own security, particularly with regard to Kurdish nationalists, and Sweden in particular has a slightly different view of those problems than the Turks have. That can be worked out. What's really going on is Erdogan using the reality of his power, the power to say no, or at least to get paid for saying yes, in order to get the maximum for him politically at home, to remind people that he's still there, to give an incentive to NATO to take his security concerns more seriously. And this is something that he has been engaged in for many, many years. Back in 2009, just before I came to Brussels as U.S. ambassador, he held up a new secretary general, the election of a new secretary general, and was able to get some concessions from that, and he's done it repeatedly since. So my sense is we will get this done before the NATO summit in late June, with the Turks agreeing to an invitation. The only question is, who's going to pay what price and when?
has circumstance strengthened Erdogan's hand? You know, Turkey is, in real life, located where it's located. On the Black Sea, near Russia, they've made solid contributions to Ukraine's resistance to the Russian invasion. If the Turks had sat this one out, would they be playing a weaker hand in their attempt to get concessions from two aspiring and critical new members?
I think he uses the power that he has by the fact that you need consensus. You know, he's also, and Turkey is, a critical player, a Black Sea power, as you mentioned. And indeed, you know, the only way military ships can get in and out of the Black Sea is if the Turks, who control access to the Black Sea, are in agreement with that. So Turkey has an important geostrategic location, but being both a European and an Asian power in the Middle East, being a Muslim country, it is a vital strategic ally of NATO. It's that vitality that gives us the power for Turkey to express its own interests and to make sure that everybody listens. But in the end, an alliance like NATO can only work if everybody is willing at some point to move ahead and do this and work together as one. And I think on the issue of NATO enlargement, that will likely happen as well.
You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez. You worked in the Obama administration. President Biden came to office promising to reconnect the U.S. to the rest of the world after 4 years of Donald Trump, after years of the U.S. distancing itself from treaties, from multilateral organizations. European leaders welcomed the overture in 2021 after the inauguration. But was it President Putin, every bit as much as President Biden, who's given NATO new energy, new sense of purpose? Has it been circumstance as much as any rhetorical elegance on the part of the United States?
Yeah, I think it's both. I mean, clearly, the threat that Russia represents to Europe has proven to be a wake-up call to Europeans who, frankly, for a very long time, had taken a holiday from history, who believe that somehow if you just talked to and engaged and traded with, Russia would behave as if it were a small, medium-sized power that would threaten no one. That wasn't the case. It hasn't been the case for a very long time. And yet there was still this belief that if only you bought more gas and more oil and you became more dependent on Russia, somehow this would work to the benefit, not just for the Russians, but for everyone else. And that's gone. That's disappeared. And as the Germans, who led in many ways this thought process, concluded immediately after the invasion started, security now requires investment in military capabilities. And just this week, the German parliament has agreed to spend 100 billion euros on re-equipping the German military as a result of it. So Vladimir Putin is critical. But that doesn't mean that Biden has been only successful because of the circumstances. It actually took very, very adroit diplomacy by the Biden administration, by the president himself, by the Secretary of State and others. From late fall last year, when the first indication were that Russia was likely to launch a military operation of this kind, to get the West ready and to bring our allies, particularly in Europe, to the point that they were willing to institute the kind of sanctions that have been instituted over the last 3 months. The European Union is just concluding its sixth round of sanctions, including a ban on importing Russian oil by ships. These are major steps that require intensive diplomacy. The same is true on the buildup of the NATO military in the East, which also takes the kind of diplomatic engagement that this administration has demonstrated it's not only capable of, but really has done in a superb way to get where we are. So yes, you need Vladimir Putin and Russia in order to get NATO to do what it needs to do. But you also need somebody to lead that effort in order that it gets done in a way that maximizes success over the long run.
Recently, at the meeting of the World Economic Forum in Davos, you called for a new revived commitment to the rules-based international order. And you know, I guess the reasons are obvious and not so obvious. Countries that are not great powers want to be able to buy and sell to the world, employ and feed their people without fear of invasion or interference or hijacking. They want to be able to forge bilateral relationships based on their sovereign decision-making power. What's at risk if President Putin succeeds in carving out a sphere, a sizable enough coterie of countries where power speaks, and more power speaks even louder? This Beijing-Moscow bilateral is pretty important. That's a big chunk of planet Earth, and they may be saying, look, you know, rules-based, sure, yeah, fine, as long as the rules work for us.
Yeah, I think that's the danger that we have. I mean, and, you know, it is true that since 1945, we've actually lived in a pretty unique period of history, a period in which, by and large, and, you know, there are exceptions, including behavior by the United States and Vietnam and other places, and of course in Iraq. But by and large, there was this idea that there are a set of rules and one lived up to them. The set of rules written out in the UN Charter and a variety of other documents, that there were a set of principles, the idea that there was a rule of law, that there were things you just didn't do because it wasn't seen as right. And that just because you had the power to get something done didn't mean you necessarily would do it. That might did not always make right. And that there were more basic sense of rules. That was the rules-based order that has existed, you know, with all its flaws and with all the problems that we have seen since 1945. If we now enter a world in which big powers can do whatever they want in their own neighbors, so they can carve out their own spheres of influence, can do what the Russians are trying to do, which is to not erase in some ways any sense of Ukraine in any part that it occupies by banning the Ukrainian language, by re-quote educating the educators, the 20,000 teachers are going to be told a new curriculum that they need to teach in the places that they're being occupied, that those who don't abide by what Russia wants them to abide by are carted off to camps in various places, that becomes the norm, that's the kind of behavior that we really didn't see since World War II, now becomes the norm, not only internally in societies, and we've seen that in China with regard to the Uyghurs. We see the erasing of the democracy in Hong Kong by the Chinese. And to see that as the norm, that means that lots of other countries are going to start behaving that way. And it is important that we do everything possible to see that they don't succeed, because otherwise we have not a world of the rule of law, but we'll have the world of the rule of the jungle. And the jungle just isn't a really great place for a lot of people to be hanging out in.
Given what you just said, it makes you wonder about what happens after the Ukraine war, however it ends. If Russia is able to establish a group of countries at its back that doesn't really care too much, too publicly, too loudly about what it just did in Ukraine, can he really rejoin the good graces of the international community, show up at international gatherings, just be a normal country again after what it's just done to Ukraine? Just pick up where we left off?
I don't think that's possible. And I think part of our policy needs to be to make sure that it isn't possible. And we have some advantages, not only because we are more free and more democratic and more prosperous than our competitors, but we also collaborate. So if you just think of the 12 largest democracies in the world, including the European Union, they're 60% of global GDP. They're 60% of global military power. And if they agree that they need to act together in opposition to this kind of behavior, that you're not going to re-engage economically with Russia. You're not going to buy their oil. You're not going to buy their gas. You're not going to buy what they have on offer. And to send a signal that if other countries behave as Russia behaves, they too will be barred from the international financial system. They too will find it increasingly difficult to use the technology that the Western world has produced and owned. That they too will find it just more difficult to engage economically, politically with the rest of the world. And that there's real cost to this kind of behavior. As long as we're willing to pay a price, which we because none of this is free, we are more likely to come out of this ahead if we're willing to cooperate together and do what we are demonstrating we're willing and capable of doing in Ukraine, which is to make sure that Ukraine can defend itself, that the Russians are being facing extraordinary costs economically and otherwise, and that Ukraine, once this is over, will become a strong member not only of the European Union, but also of NATO, that it has the benefit of being part of that system, so that in the end, the cost to Russia is so great that other countries may decide this is something that the Russians may want to try to do, but we're not going to try to do it because it just doesn't make any sense.
You know, in the near term, though, Ukrainians are dying. Ukrainian cities are being blasted to rubble, you know, like Grozny in Chechnya during the early phase of Putin's presidency. Henry Kissinger recently urged Ukraine to consider trading land for peace, in effect. Would that work?
For one reason, the Ukrainians are not in a position or willing to trade land for peace because it's their land. And more importantly, it's not clear that if they do so, they will have any peace because Vladimir Putin isn't in this for just a little land. He's in it because he wants to control Ukraine. And the Ukrainians know that, that if you give in, if for some reason you find a way to have Putin succeed, then even if there is peace today, there will likely be more war tomorrow. That's what we learned in 2014. Remember, there were two peace agreements, Minsk I and Minsk II. It didn't do anything. It didn't solve the problem. Even though Crimea became Russian, which is what, by the way, Henry Kissinger suggested they do at the time as well, it didn't provide for peace. It just laid the foundation for more war. I think we learned from World War II. I think we learned from previous history. When you allow aggression to succeed, it doesn't lead to less aggression down the road or peace. It leads to more aggression down the road. That's the lesson that we've all learned. Certainly the lesson that the Ukrainians have learned. And whatever Henry Kissinger thinks, I don't see the Ukrainians adopting a situation where they say, you can have a little of our country if you don't do anything further, because they know that if they have a little bit of the country, they'll try to take more.
President Biden has shied away from giving Ukraine weapons that can be used in offensive ways against Russia. Are there lines, are there tense borders between what you can give them at this point and what maybe you shouldn't give them at this point?
So I'm not quite exactly where the president is on this issue. I think there's certain weapons you don't provide, nuclear weapons. We don't have chemical or biological weapons, but those kinds of weapons you don't provide. But I think the dividing line isn't about the range of the weapons. I think the dividing line is providing weapons or ourselves getting involved in a conflict. The idea that somehow if you have a missile that can go 180 kilometers and therefore might or might not get into inside Russia at a time when the Russians are pounding in the way you mentioned every city, every place with extraordinary military might in Ukraine, that somehow if we provide those capabilities, it, quote, will be provocative and lead to World War III. I just don't see that happening. I think what could lead to a conflict is us getting directly involved. I think the president is right to have drawn the line there, for NATO to have drawn the line there. No direct military engagement by our forces. Indirect, we should do everything to help Ukraine defend itself, but no direct military engagement. And the idea that somehow certain kind of weapons are more provocative than others, again, with the exception of things like nuclear weapons, I really don't see that that's where you want to draw the line. I think you want to draw the line on our direct engagement rather than the kind of weapons that we provide.
Ivo Dalder is a former U.S. ambassador to NATO. He's now president of the Chicago Council of Global Affairs. He's the host of the World Review podcast. Good to talk to you, Ambassador. Thanks a lot.
Ray, always a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and from listeners like you. Additional support was provided by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which is working alongside others to build a culture of health for everyone in America. If you want to support the program by becoming a member or making a donation of any size, please go to worldaffairs.org/donate. And we want to hear from you. What did you think about today's episode? Are there any international stories you'd like us to cover? Please send an email or a voice memo to feedback@worldaffairs.org. Today's episode was produced by Andrew Stelzer and Dan Zoll, with scoring, sound design, and mastering by Matteo Schimpf. Research and fact-checking was provided by our associate producer, Ryan Housel. Additional production and engineering provided by Rob Spate. Jim Bennett is our technical supervisor. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. Our executive producer is Joanne Jennings. Philip Yun is CEO of World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez. Thanks for listening.